All right, so you've lived in a few different places. You say you started life in Manchester.
Yeah, so I lived for the first 18 years of my life in Salford, just outside Manchester. Sort of grew up, went to school there and had my family and everything, and couldn't wait to get away, couldn't wait to leave. So was really applying for anywhere and everywhere to go to university. And ended up in North London, which was brilliant because it was, London was the place I wanted to be. I kind of saw London very much as this accepting cosmopolitan city where anything goes and anybody could be themselves, and it was the place I had to be. Growing up in Manchester, I was kind of buying all the music magazines, new sounds, new styles, The Face, all that kind of stuff, and really following all the club culture, the Blitz and places like that. And just being so madly in love with that whole sort of scene that was of the new romantic scene in the early 80s. Couldn't wait to get down to London, and I still am a massive Soft Cell fan. The first place I went to was Soho, and just spending all my weekends in my first year at college down in Soho, just walking around, getting to know people and hanging out around the Soft Cell offices. And it was just amazing. Soho was just such an incredible place then. And it's kind of become very sanitized now, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I mean, was the Blitz Soho? That's where it was. Yeah, Covent Garden, or
yeah,
was it?
Yeah, that sort of area. Yeah. And Soho, having got the Non-Stop Erotic Cabaret album, Soho was like the place I had to be. And it was that was my tribe. It was amazing. And so here was I, this naive 18-year-old. Fresh from the streets of Manchester, too terrified to go on the bus at home because of all the abuse I'd get and whatever, but finding my home in London and finding myself and learning who I was and all that kind of stuff, as well as trying to do teacher training as well,
Oh, wow, that's incredible. So it was a voyage of discovery for yourself, really, then, to go to that.
It really was, it really was.
And did you sort of find that when you were living in Manchester, and perhaps you hadn't found yourself, you were lost a little bit? Yeah. Or was it that you knew who you were but weren't able to be that, if that makes sense?
It was a mixture of the two things, really. I knew that I was gay from an early age. I knew sort of really when I was about 12, when the other kids at school kind of taught me the words to describe who I was. And till then, I'd just known I was different. Or, I remember having a conversation actually with my mum. I've got a very vivid memory of being about 4 years old, maybe four or five, and sitting on the metal sink drainer with my feet in the sink and my mum sort of washing me in the sink. Mm. And me saying to my mum, "Mum, what's a fairy?" And she said, "Well, where have you heard that?" And so it's what the kids at school are calling me.
Oh,
and she said, "Oh, just ignore them. Kids are rotten to each other, aren't they?"
Yeah, yeah.
And it was that kind of growing up, knowing that I was different, searching for, the tiniest glimmers of anything positive, or any mention of the word gay on TV or in papers and stuff, and kind of hanging on to stories that people would sort of say, do you know Freddie Mercury? Do you know why he called his band Queen? And all this kind of, and I thought, oh God, And so at 12 at secondary, which was horrendous, being bullied by the kids, and the teachers actually joined in. That was very, very nice of them. I was told, I did Latin. I was told in my Latin class by the teacher that I was the favourite topic of conversation in the staff room because of who I was and how I behaved. And it was like, oh God, And here was me thinking I'm hiding it. I've got this mask I'm wearing, and really I think the only person I was fooling was myself. So I kind of endured secondary school, went to sixth form, a different sixth form, in Eccles, which was doing music and Latin. And it was then that I really kind of, I think because I'd got away from a lot of the bullying, and I was kind of given that space to be a bit more who I really was. Came out to a couple of people, and it was fine. And then just really couldn't wait to get away. So my final 6 months were horrendous in some ways. I tried to commit suicide, which was because of just thinking, you know, I'm gay, there's nobody else like me, I'm the only one in the world, it's horrendous. And then going through all that and kind of getting rejected from different universities I was applying to, and then getting this one acceptance, and I just had to get a grade E at A level in music to get there, and the excitement that kind of generated in me was, you know, was it was like a light had been switched on.
Yeah, you had your ticket.
Yeah, that was my ticket away from Manchester and down to London. And my God, I was going to be myself at last. And, you know, and that was it.
You said that, I love this term and this phrase, fight, you found your tribe.
Yeah.
And I think you do, don't you? And I think often it is when you're, you know, sort of maybe mid to late teens, and you're having that opportunity of being away from the bubble of the area of you, where you grew up, and maybe that was a restrictive, or it was a safety thing, or it was, you know, something that where you felt like you couldn't be yourself and trapped.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And those bubbles can have different impacts, I suppose. But that bit of finding your tribe, I mean, what was it about going to London that helped you navigate that?
I just think it kind of gave me the space to be away from all the restrictions and the traps that I felt in Manchester, you know, and to be able to explore London and to find all the different kind of places to go, all the different sort of, you know, the clubs with the blacked out windows and all the little the gay shops, you know, that with the little hatch in the door that people would look out of and check who you were and see if you were okay to come in, kind of thing.
Wow.
And all that sort of secrecy and furtiveness, and there's something slightly sordid about it, and it just touched something deep within me that the Soft Cell album had kind of opened that door.
Yeah.
You know, and they were singing about the underbelly of London, and it was this place I knew I had to be a part of. And I kind of scratched the surface of it in a lot of ways, and found where I belonged. And it literally was like finding the last piece of the jigsaw, if you like. And I was in London for a term, came home to Manchester, came out to my mum, went back to London, and was just living the best life.
Wow.
I was training to be a teacher, which is a job that I'd wanted to do since I was 12. And, you know, so I was really happy about that. Didn't really always see eye to eye with the lecturers, because here was I, an openly gay man, wanting to work with kids.
Yeah.
So I was compared on a number of occasions by the lecturers to being a paedophile.
Wow.
Which were, you know, that kind of, it didn't match with how I thought London was supposed to be, and I was kind of lumping everybody in London in this one big, you know, thing of acceptance. So I wasn't getting acceptance from my peers and from my lecturers. So I really had to prove that I was better than the best, and I was doing amazing assessments on teacher training, and I was doing well in the classroom, and I was doing, you know, lectures, and I was, you know, being the very, very best version of me that I could be.
Yeah.
And, you know, and passed with a 2-1, and, you know, all this comparison, oh, you can't be gay and be a teacher.
Wow.
And in my first job, I worked in a school in King's Cross, where there were two other gay men on the staff, and the school was the one where Kenneth Williams had been as a child. So it was like, I, you know, again, I've really found my place where I belong.
Yeah.
And I had 5 really happy years there.
Great.
It was amazing.
Great. And you sort of worked your way up in teaching, so to speak, to sort of senior positions and things like that, didn't you?
Yes, I did. So I'd kind of, I guess, bumbled through my teaching career for a while. For
I know that feeling.
I can't believe that of you, Chris. But yeah, you know, and I had no aspirations beyond the classroom. I had my sort of my music side bubbling under because I was employed as a music teacher, but I had my own sort of stuff going on. I started, as you know, I started the London Gay Men's Choir.
Yeah.
And I was writing and I was performing, and teaching during the day and doing my other passionate bit in the evenings.
Yeah.
And then I kind of, well, my mum passed away. And it kind of made me reevaluate everything, because her death was like a completely out of the blue, totally unexpected. So it hit me like a ton of bricks, and it made me just stop. It actually made me stop and reevaluate everything that I wanted out of life.
Yeah,
and that included looking at my job and actually thinking, well, you know, you've enjoyed what you've done. You've got all these skills. I found that I really loved working as much with kids as with adults. So I thought, you know, the job of Key Stage 2 leader came up at the school where I was working. And this was in Leytonstone in East London. And I thought, you know, I'm going to go for that. And went for it and got it. And the head teacher actually said to me, I hoped you would apply for this, which was a big sort of, you know, accolade for me.
Yeah.
And I just found I really enjoyed being in the sort of that senior management role. Didn't enjoy the meetings
No.
and all the extra stuff that came with it, but I loved working with the adults and managing people.
Yeah.
And then from there, I was asked by a school down the road to go and do some music and performing arts classes with their kids. And I loved it, and it was great. And then the position of deputy head came up at that school, and I thought, do you know, I'm going to go for this.
Yeah.
I'm going to, you know, it could be something that I'm going to be really good at. And, you know, I knew the head and loved the head, still do. She's still, you know, still a good friend. And applied for it. Got on really well with the chair of governors, who was this amazing man, Neil Chubb, absolutely amazing man. And we hit it off at interview, and I got the job, and it was like, wow, you know. So that was Easter 2006, and
yeah.
I spent 10 very, very happy years. So, you know, ups and downs, as you know, as there are in any job, but really loving it. And you know, the school has a very, very special place in my heart. It's called Jenny Hammond, the Jenny Hammond Primary School.
Fantastic.
In East London. Absolutely amazing place to work. And yeah, so that was the last 10 years of my teaching career.
Incredible. So do you think that if you'd have stayed in Manchester and not taken the leap to find your tribe, that you'd have had that mindset of, oh, I'll have a go at that?
No, I don't think I would have been here if I'd stayed in Manchester.
Wow.
I think I'd be 6 feet under.
Yeah.
You know, even though Manchester now is, you know, it's got Canal Street and, you know, all the gay. It's funny, actually, because I've got an uncle who's gay. Mm. Talk about the gay gene. And
is that a thing? I didn't know that was a thing. Is that a
well,
thing?
Do you know? Yeah, I think it is. I think
right.
It is. And it comes down the male side of my family. So my uncle, my dad's side.
Yeah.
And he is, talk about a gay stereotype, he's an interior designer.
Right.
And he designed a lot of the interiors of gay clubs in Manchester.
Oh, cool.
And he is one of the most amazing, you know, I know he's my uncle and I love him dearly, but he's an amazing man. He's just an incredible person to know.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, Manchester is now is the place that perhaps I could have done with, like, you know, when I was 18, all those years ago. But you know, London did its job, and it got me to where I am now. And I've, you know, I had 32 more or less very happy years in London. Met my husband in London.
Wow, yeah.
You know, we adopted our kids in London, and you know, so it served its purpose.
Phenomenal, yeah. Well, yeah, let's zoom in on the passion side of things then. In terms of, you talked about the choir that you founded and worked on. Was that your sort of first major musical project?
Well, I'd kind of been immersed in music from a very early age. My mum and dad played. My mum played piano. My dad played the E flat euphonium. My grandmother my mum's mum was a pianist. Mm. She played for for the silent movies in Manchester.
Oh,
which
cool!
Was really, incredible.
Yeah.
And so I was really immersed in it from a very early age, and just grew up absolutely loving music. I was having piano lessons when I was four, and playing recorder at primary school, and then the flute at secondary. I had the most amazing music teacher, David Wotton, at secondary, who I'm still in touch with, and he inspired me to be a music teacher. So I was, I was writing songs. I was doing sort of performances and stuff at school. Learned that I had a singing voice when I was sort of 14, 15, singing along with like Hazel O'Connor and Soft Cell, sort of developing that, and then performing and stuff at sixth form. I actually played the part of Boy George in a musical that we wrote at sixth form called Tarzan the Musical. And how they managed to work Boy George into that, I'll never know to this day. But anyway, you know, and here was I wasn't completely out at that point, but I was playing this flamboyant, very gay role. And oh my God, it was amazing.
Yeah,
it was the most wonderful 5 nights I think I've had, certainly at that time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was doing all these little projects on the side, writing and playing and performing when I could. So when I visited a London friend, I came out of a really disastrous relationship and found London friend and volunteered for them and met lots of amazing people. And one of the guys I met was a guy called Louis, and we kind of hit it off and connected on our love of music. He's this Greek guy, and so I love world music, and we connected on the Greek sort of side of music.
Brilliant.
And he just said to me one night, "Do you fancy starting a choir?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely." So there was like me and him and three other guys, and one of the guys was an accordionist, and we just stood one night, one Christmas, at London Friend. They had a little place in near King's Cross, and we stood and just sang Christmas carols. And it kind of snowballed from there. So many people kind of... Oh, sorry, that was a pun, wasn't it? Christmas. So, sorry, that was completely unintentional. But anyway, it grew from there. We ended up with about 30 members.
Hmm.
And I think it's sort of synchronicity. I got enough money together to buy myself my very own first piano, my very first Yamaha Clavinova.
Wow.
Which, you know,
a proper one as well.
A proper one. And I literally got delivery of this piano, and I think within a couple of days I'd started writing a Requiem Mass, as you do, you know. you know, well, what shall I write? I'll write this full-scale Requiem Mass. You know, I love Benjamin Britten's War Requiem, and I kind of took that as my inspiration for the format of my Requiem. So it's all the different movements of the Requiem Mass interspersed with poems, either spoken or set to music. And I wrote it for the choir, so I was very much writing for people who were very amateur, who loved singing, and who, you know, that enthusiasm that they had kind of carried them through the 10 months that I was writing and bringing the Requiem to the different rehearsals we had, and then really kind of focusing for about 6 months on really intensive rehearsals. And
Clarify, you weren't a choir that were just taking existing songs necessarily and performing your own covers and arrangements and renditions of those. You were actually creating the material yourself. Is that, have I got the right end of that?
We were,
yeah.
Yeah, we were doing very much a mixture. So it was people in the choir writing stuff for the choir to perform, us doing cover versions, me doing arrangements of songs and things that have, you know, of sort of classic stuff. A real mixture. I mean, we'd do Motown, we'd be doing Erasure, we'd be doing original material, and it'd all be, you know, it would be absolutely amazing and the very best that we could do. Like I say, they were a really enthusiastic bunch of guys, and it was an amazing sort of couple of years. And so I kind of got together this bunch of celebrities, if you like. So Jimmy Harkishin, who now plays Dev in Coronation Street.
Oh, right.
Just as we were performing the Requiem, which we did in Manchester, he got the call to go and join the Coronation Street cast. So it's, you know, he was a lovely man. Terrible flirt, a real flirt, which was lovely because he's gorgeous.
Yeah.
But people like Gordon Warnecker, the Asian guy from My Beautiful Laundrette.
Right.
He, you know, a real ally, straight man, as Jimmy Harkishin is, but a real ally. And Georgina Hale, the actress. I've got a friend, Mac Andrews, who was an actor. And they kind of got together and they read the poems, and some people from the choir sang some of the poems, and they did the Requiem. And we performed it at the Free Trade Hall in Manchester, which was amazing because the week before we'd done the Go West with the Pet Shop Boys at the London Palladium.
Yes.
So it was like, what a week. It was, it was the October half term week, and we'd started it off with singing with the Pet Shop Boys and ended it doing this concert.
That's good going, isn't it?
My God, my life at that time, it was such a whirlwind. You know, trying to rehearse with these celebrities, trying to rehearse with the choir, trying to teach, trying to rehearse with the choir and the Pet Shop Boys and all that kind of stuff.
As you do,
going up and down. I know, terrible. I'm such a name dropper. It's ridiculous. But you know, I'm going up and down on the train up to Manchester and London, and you know, having meetings and doing radio stuff in Manchester to try and promote and sell tickets. We only sold 100 tickets, and it was this, you know, this vast cavernous performance space, but everyone was clapping really loudly, so it was great. I've got a lovely live recording of it.
Fantastic.
You know, it was a really amazing experience, and looking back on it now at what we achieved and what I achieved in writing it, it's, you know, I'm really proud of it. It was a really amazing piece of music.
Beautiful.
You know, so that's Undying Heart, a Requiem for AIDS, it was called.
Incredible. Is there how could I hear that?
I can send you a recording of it.
That'd be amazing.
And I think I've even got one of the original programs somewhere, so I'll put that together for you.
Oh, that'd be stunning. Yeah, it'd be great. And if there's a way that we could share it as well, and, you know, so people could hear it in some way, that'd be
absolutely. I mean, you know, as awesome. I say, it's a live recording, so it's warts and all. It's a really, you know, it's an amazing performance. I'm thinking actually now of trying to put a fundraising evening together of the poems from the Requiem, you know, trying to do fundraising, you know, post COVID, as you know, Derbyshire LGBT plus, we are working at a deficit and we're struggling for money.
Right.
So if I can do a fundraiser, it would be amazing.
Yeah, that sounds mega.
Yeah,
that sounds wicked. So let's talk about Derbyshire LGBT plus, because so obviously at some point you move from London to Derby, right? Or is it bits in between that? Or,
well, no, I was coming up really sort of around about 2012, 2013, coming up for weekends away in Derbyshire. And when I was at secondary school, actually, my form teacher, who absolutely loathed and detested me, she brought a few of us up to Crich, to the the tramway museum, you know. And I remember thinking with my husband Steve, thinking, oh, where shall we go? And I thought, no, I enjoyed Crich, let's go to Crich. So we found this place that we rented for a week, which was a converted granary, absolutely gorgeous. And we had a lovely week, and we both of us just absolutely fell in love with Derbyshire. with the people, with the you know the landscape, with you know absolutely everything. Because we'd kind of felt very protected in the bubble of London, and had been very unsure. You know, can we take a risk of actually moving out? Will people be accepting? Will you know? And we had no problems whatsoever coming up here for visits. So we did more and more visits over the years, and then we adopted our two kids in 2014. And thought, you know, London's great, but we really want somewhere where our kids can be safe, and we, you know, they can play out in the street, and you know we can kind of enjoy the scenery and be out in the countryside and all those kind of positive things that you get from living in Derbyshire.
Yeah.
So we thought, no, let's, you know, the time's right. So 2016, we sold our house. We moved up here, bought a lovely house, and you know, never looked back.
Mm-hmm. Incredible.
And yeah, Derbyshire is we love it.
Mm. It is a beautiful place. I mean, someone who's lived here their entire life, you know, you sort of take things for granted, don't you, when you're from places
I took London very much for granted.
Yeah,
but you know, Derbyshire. Yeah, we're still discovering the county, still discovering new places to go and visit and stuff, and I just love that everywhere is so easy to get to.
Yes.
You know, I can go and I used to, before my dad passed away, I used to go and visit my dad in Manchester. It'd be a couple of hours, which was great. We drive down to London to meet up with foster families and siblings and stuff like that, and that's 3 hours away, and that's great.
Yeah.
Nottingham's wonderful. You know, the only thing is we're so far from the sea, but
yeah.
There you go, you know, but you know, Skeggy's not too far away, and there's Southport I suppose, and Filey and places like that, but we really feel like we landed on our feet making the decision to move up to Derbyshire.
Yeah No, that's fantastic. So how did your involvement come through with Derbyshire LGBT Plus as an organisation?
Wow. Well, yeah. So again, a series of happy coincidences, really.
Mm.
So I did a lot of work in London with Stonewall, and through Stonewall met up with somebody who works, Claire Austin, who works for Derbyshire County Council. Because it's separate, isn't it? Derbyshire County Council.
Yeah.
So I met up with Claire, and she asked me if I would be the keynote speaker at a conference. And I did it because, you know, that's what I love doing. And one of the workshops being run at the conference was by who is now my manager and CEO. And I went to the workshop because I thought, you know, make that connection. And I love networking. I'm very good at networking and love talking to people and meeting people, as you might imagine. And, you know, try and shut me up. But anyway, I went in and I'd written all these resources for of lesson activities and stuff for primary schools to teach about LGBT families and different families and issues and all that kind of stuff. And I went up afterwards and spoke to Ian Robson, who is the CEO of D+. And I said, you know, I've got these resources. Would you be interested in seeing them? You know, I'd like to get them published at some point, but you know, maybe see if you can use them. And he metaphorically bit my hand off.
Wow.
And he said, you know, absolutely, we are looking to go into schools. We would love to publish your resource. Come for a meeting. So I thought, oh yeah, you know, bit cynical, got my London head on, you know,
yeah.
Been promised so many things over the years that had never materialised. And I thought, oh well, maybe this is just one of those things. And true to his word, literally the following week he phoned me up, we arranged a meeting, I went along and he said, you know, get these ready to be published and, you know, and we'll get them graphically designed and all that kind of stuff and we'll publish them. And literally, I think it was about 8 months or so later, it was published. And this is a resource that I now use when I go into schools and do teacher training and stuff.
Brilliant.
And, you know, I've never looked back. So as part of these meetings about my resource, Ryan Whittington, my manager, said, we've got this role that we need to fill sort of pretty quickly. We've been given a pot of money by the Office of the Police and Crime Commissioner for Derbyshire. It's hate crime advocate. Would you be interested? And I said, yeah, absolutely, without hesitating, because it kind of fitted very much with the work that I was doing in schools on tackling bullying.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've been there myself. I've been, you know, a victim of bullying, a victim of hate crime, and it just seemed like it landed in my lap, and that it was the right time, and it's what I really wanted to do. And this was, when was this? 2018 now.
Yeah, yeah.
And my contract with the hate crime advocate role has been renewed sort of year on year by the Office of the Police and Crime Commissioner, who I think is absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
In what he does for hate crime nationally and locally, and you know it's a role that I love doing because I'm absolutely passionate about. As I was with my teaching, about being the person that I needed in that situation. So if I can be that glimmer of hope for that one gay kid in school by going into schools and saying, hey, I'm gay and it's okay. Or if I can be that person who is going to support somebody who's been through a really sort of fundamental attack on their identity, whether that's a physical attack or a verbal attack, it's still, you know, it still kind of affects people so deeply. And if I can be the person that I needed in that situation, then I will have done my job properly. We've got an amazing team at D+. There's only a few of us, only like a team of sort of four or five of us. Not all working full time either, so we're really stretched. And as I say, you know, we are working at a massive deficit because we've not been able to income generate, like lots of charities.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We've not been able to income generate because we get a lot of our income from going out doing training.
Gotcha.
And going into schools, going into organisations to deliver our training packages. So we've missed out on that for the whole year. So you know, we need to raise money. We need to get out there and be doing what we're good at. And we're going to be launching our own accreditation scheme this year.
Fantastic.
To enable businesses to be fully LGBT inclusive at all levels. And we're hopefully going to get our Rainbow Allies scheme launched as well, which is for smaller businesses, so like shops and therapists and, you know, people who are working for themselves kind of thing.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, so I live local to Belper.
Yeah.
And they have their first Belper Pride. I should say Pride in Belper.
Right, yeah.
Which was, you know, about 18 months ago now. And we're hoping that Belper is going to become our first rainbow town, where every shop and local business buys into our Rainbow Allies scheme. And because, you know, the Belper community is absolutely incredible. There were so many rainbow flags and things still up now, you know, 18 months down the line.
Wow.
You know, who are really kind of keen. They were all the shops were kind of trying to outdo themselves with how many gender neutral toilets they could possibly have. Who can have the most rainbows and who can be the most gay friendly. And it was the most amazing place to be in the UK on that one particular day. And I love Belper anyway. It's just one of the most amazing places. But, you know, I feel really safe walking down the street knowing that there's all this community support.
Yeah.
You know, there were 2,000 people crammed into Belper High Street. And it was just one of the most amazing Pride events ever. Pride in Belper committee is just incredible. They worked so hard and made it such a massive success.
And Belper, of all places, you know what I mean?
I
mean, you know.
Yeah, this tiny little village.
Yeah.
And it's just, I just love Belper. You know, I do one of my groups, because I run three groups for the over 50s through D+.
Yeah.
They're my Golden Rainbows group. And one of the groups meets in Belper. And it's the biggest of our three groups. And you know, you just meet such incredible people with so many amazing life stories. You know, a lot of these older men, particularly, who have gone through that whole time pre-1967 when it was illegal to be gay.
Yeah.
And the stories they come out with would, you know, make you laugh and cry, and all the sort of the ingenuity that they had to find other people. You know, talk about finding your tribe.
Yeah.
You know, finding other people like them. And, you know, it just puts the icing on the cake for me, going to Belper and meeting with this group. They're incredible. I, you know, I have to say, you know, I love my Derby group and I love my Chesterfield group.
Yeah.
And the Belper group is just, you know, they're all amazing people. They are incredible.
Absolutely fantastic. So we've covered a load of ground, but I do want to sort of, you know, come back to music a little bit before we finish, because of, you know, that's not gone away, has it? You know, since the choir, you've still been creating and still been writing and performing. And I mean, could we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm, you know, I am hoping to start a new choir up, which would be through D+, but I need more of an outlet. But yeah, I've been, I mean, my latest project is my Spanish songs. And this kind of took 26 years really to come to the physical copy of the CD, which I, you know, I hold proudly in my hand. Yeah, I guess like lots of creative people, we have that inner voice that says, you know, who do you think you are? No one's going to be interested in this and all this kind of stuff. And so I've kind of battled with this over the years and won the battle finally. You know,
the battle against yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's one of the hardest battles to win. You know, because I knew when I first performed three of my songs that are now, they're now 10, and I did it in a concert at London Lighthouse at the AIDS Hospice there, and loved doing it, and they went down really, really well. And then over the years, I've kind of added to it and tweaked it and developed it and got rid of a lot and, you know, honed it and, you know, and then I, as we do, use social media, and I said, you know, I've got these songs and I'd really like to get them recorded. I'm looking for a pianist so that I can just focus on singing. And somebody on Facebook said, why don't you contact Martin Watkins? And Martin Watkins is the guy who has played piano for Mark Allman for about 30 years.
Isn't that just a beautiful loop back?
Yeah. So, and it's like, you know, who, that inner voice coming out, who do you think you are? Yeah. Contacting Martin Watkins. Yeah. He's not going to want to know. He's this incredible musician. He's working with like some of the most amazing people, you know. And then so I thought, oh, you know, this sort of, I'd put this out on social media, I want this pianist. Nobody came forward. And I thought, right, I'm gonna bite the bullet. I'm gonna contact Martin, and I was kind of, as you do, sort of friends with Martin on Facebook. He was, you know, one of my Facebook mates who I don't know, but you know, I like him.
Yeah.
And so I messaged him, and he said, "Well, send me what you've got, and I'll have a look." Now I've got Sibelius, brilliant music program, so I had it all printed out, all looked really professional. Sent it to him, and he loved it. And he's, you know, right from the word go, he said, this is something I really want to be involved in. You know, come and visit me. He lives in Manchester. Come and visit me. So going back to my hometown. So yeah, I'd say going full circle with the Mark Allman thing, but also going back to Manchester.
Yeah.
And I went and rehearsed with him, and it was amazing. I absolutely loved the rehearsals. You know, I work a long day. I give everything to a job because that's my work ethic. I give absolutely 100% or I won't do it. You know, and I'm left sort of wrung out at the end of the day. I was doing these rehearsals with Martin, and I was singing non-stop for about 4 hours, and I could have done 24 hours. It was that kind of, we had a real connection. And he works with Spanish musicians as well. So again, he's got that kind of Spanish connection. And he would suggest things. And, oh, do you think it might sound better if you did this or that? And it was all done so respectfully and so kind of treated me like like a proper sort of performer and composer. Mm. And I felt really, it sounds really kind of pretentious, but I felt really validated.
Beautiful.
And I felt, yeah. you know, I felt really sort of like I'd, like I was meant to be there.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we had sort of five or six rehearsals when COVID allowed, and went into the studio in Manchester, the Hope Mill Recording Studio. It's funny, and I'm going to name drop again, it's dreadful, but it's a studio where Gloria Gaynor had recorded some stuff.
Oh, brilliant.
And it's like, I've stood in the same sound booth as Gloria Gaynor, it's like, you know, in this amazing recording studio. And we had this brilliant engineer, a guy called Steve Poppleton, who just... He just understood it. He understood yeah. what I wanted. I could just describe how I wanted it to sound, and I wanted it to sound like it was on a street corner in Spain, or one of these little tiny Spanish tablaos, where a musician had just got up to sing.
Mm.
And he said, right, let's try doing it with this, and let's use this. So underneath all the songs is Spanish street sounds.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just sort of, you know, just sort of random people having a conversation or whatever, you know, church bells chiming, and he got it. He understood the whole process.
I'll tell you what, John, when I was listening to it, I'm glad you said that, because I was, it's so authentic that I was listening to it going, oh, it's a live recording. He recorded it live in a cafe or something. So it's like,
brilliant.
I properly got that.
Fantastic. Because I love, I don't know if you know Björk and what's the song? There's More to Life Than This, where she sounds like she's singing into a little tape recorder.
Yeah, I love
stuff
she's
like in a
that.
Club and she goes into the toilet and the sound kind of changes and the door opens. I wanted that sort of realness of this.
Yeah, this oral experience.
In the Spanish stuff. Yes. Totally.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah.
And we've got a friend who runs an amazing Spanish restaurant in Nottingham called Vida Balorentes, a guy called Vicente, and I managed to sort of pin him down, and he speaks a spoken bit at the beginning of one of the songs, and it's just so lovely to hear him as part of the project, because he's been a real mate over the past 4 years.
Brilliant.
And you know, it's lovely to have, because he's kind of looked at my lyrics and made sure that they were, you know, saying what I wanted them to say. And so he's, you know, he's been involved in that, and he's been incredible.
Stunning. So if people kind of want to contact you, want to connect with you, either through, you know, D Plus or in terms of the, you know, exploring the music or anything else for that matter, what's the best way for people to connect?
I guess the best way would be to email me, probably. As a Philip Glass fan, there's a Philip Glass song cycle called Songs from Liquid Days, which is brilliant. You've got to listen to it, it's absolutely amazing. But my email address is liquid_days@hotmail.co.uk. So it's liquid, as you might imagine, as it's spelt, DAYS, liquid_days@hotmail.co.uk. So that's probably the easiest way of getting hold of me.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, this has been awesome. It's been a wicked conversation and a brilliant story.
Chris.
And this is probably the first chapter of many, I'd imagine. So
absolutely
brilliant.
It's just been really lovely. So thanks for this. It's been an amazing opportunity just to talk about my passions with somebody who is equally passionate about music.
Awesome.
Wonderful. Thank you.